Hi, I'm Ina Garten, the Barefoot Contessa, and you're listening to Food Fridays with Leonard Lope on WNYC and WNYC.org.
The quality of New York's restaurants have made the city a food destination for years, but food production has been a big business in the city for centuries. And over all that time, millions of New Yorkers have raised, grown, and made their own food for their families, friends, and neighbors. Robin Schulman taps into this long history in her book, Eat the City, a tale of the fishers, foragers, butchers, farmers, poultry minders, sugar refiners, cane cutters, beekeepers, winemakers, and brewers who built New York. It's published by Crown. And also joining us are Latif Gigi, who has transformed his Upper East Side brownstone into a vertical winery, and Imran Uddin, who owns a slaughterhouse in Queens. And I'm very pleased to welcome all three of them to our show today for Food Friday.
So happy to be here.
Robin, New York City's agrarian past is evident in many of the city names. Pearl Street was named after the oyster shells that you used to find there.
Yeah, you can see evidence of the long history of food production all over the city.
Bowery?
Yeah, Bowery. In Brooklyn, there's Havemeyer Street, which was named after the family that built the giant sugar refinery there. Throughout the city, there have been hog towns and various Pigville and neighborhoods named after animals.
And now we have the Meatpacking District.
The Meatpacking District.
We know where that comes from.
Which was never actually really called the Meatpacking District when it was full of active meat markets.
It only, when it became a chic place where you can find the latest fashions and very little meat.
Yeah, often the food becomes noticed in a different way when it's a nostalgic thing, when it's already disappearing.
Also, Manhattan Island used to be a great source for everything, wasn't it? Wild berries. There were deer. There were rabbits.
You know, when the Europeans first came to Manhattan, they wrote these lyrical descriptions of all the incredible foods they found here. And the Dutch who came ate buffalo and venison.
There were buffalo in New York?
Yeah, they ate all kinds of wild foods here. They talked about wild rabbits and part of what attracted to them to this place was just how fecund it was and how much there was to offer in terms of the vegetables, the fruits, the meats.
Your book is as much about the traditions of home food production in New York City as it is about the people doing it today. Were you surprised by how far back these traditions went?
I really was. And I was surprised by how influential the food has been on the shaping of New York City. Things like sugar production was an instrumental force in the growth of New York City, and it produced a lot of the city's wealth in the 1700s and 1800s.
The Domino sugar plant? Anything else?
There were many sugar refineries before Domino, and Domino was the biggest. When it was built in the 1850s, it was the largest of its kind. It was described when it was rebuilt a couple decades later as a castle on the waterfront. So it really kind of dominated city industry.
And now people live in that building. When did New Yorkers stop raising their food and start buying it from others?
Well, I mean, in my book, I describe how they continue to raise some of their food and buy and sell among neighbors. But really, I think in the 1800s, there was this new idea of the sophisticated city that precluded the kind of food production that had long taken place here, the kind of agricultural production. People kept hogs in the streets. In the 1840s, there were 10,000 pigs roaming the streets of the city, and people were growing their own vegetables, and even cows were still grazing in the streets of Manhattan, in the lots in Manhattan. So that really changed, and people came to have this idea that these things should be banished to more distant places, and to have a modern city, you had to banish this kind of production.
And they did ban having hogs, which wouldn't have bothered you, Imran, at all. You don't sell pork.
No, we don't. We're strictly halal, but we pretty much carry everything else, all different breeds of poultry, goat, lamb.
And how many of the animals that you sell come from nearby?
Oh, the majority of them. We get all our poultry from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and also New Jersey.
The Amish
area. Mennonite. And also out in Montville, New Jersey as well.
Latif, where did you get the vine that you planted in your backyard in 1977?
Yes, I bought it in a local store. And just it was a small stick, and I took it to the backyard. And when my wife was not looking, I stuck it in the ground. And
why did you have to sneak it in the ground when your wife wasn't looking?
Well, she considered the backyard as her domain. And in fact, she knew a lot about plants and gardening. And so I was glad to let her do that, but I wanted to do my thing.
And how long before it started producing grapes that you could harvest?
It took about 7 years, yes.
Now, the stick was for an indigenous New York grape.
Yes, it was. It's called Niagara.
And then the vine keeps on growing, right? So how far did it grow?
Well, it started 15 feet away from the back wall in the backyard. And moved towards the wall, and then grew four stories up against the back wall, and then another story on the roof over a trellis, covering 45 feet of the roof. So it's about 100 feet long.
So when you want to harvest the grapes, you have to climb up on your roof?
Well, we do. Yes, most of the harvest is on the roof. Roof.
My guests are Latif Gigi, who makes wine in his brownstone on the Upper East Side, Imran Uddin, who owns a slaughterhouse in Queens, and Robin Shulman, who's written a book called Eat the City. It is published by Crown. Robin, the beginnings of this book seem to come from the time that you lived in Alphabet City in the early 1990s. That area wasn't exactly known for its food at the time, was it?
It wasn't known for it, but, you know, when I moved to the neighborhood I was living on, 4th Street between Avenue C and Avenue D, the block was pretty depleted, and there were a series of more than a dozen vacant lots adjacent to my apartment building, and people were just using it to trade drugs and shoot up and fall asleep in the trash. And then my neighbors really cleaned it up, and I helped out a little bit and shoveled up syringes from the vacant lots. And people started planting things and planted all kinds of things, brought in roosters. I was waking up to the sounds of some very noisy, confused city roosters.
You cannot keep roosters in the city now. You can keep chickens.
Yeah, there are still probably little pockets on the edges of the city where people have roosters, but they're banned. The problem is that where you find chickens, you often find roosters. They come together.
So then you moved away from the neighborhood, and what did you find when you came back?
The neighborhood had really changed. It had been built up. A lot of the gardens that had existed and had really transformed the neighborhood because people wanted to produce food there and had made the effort to clean up spaces. A lot of those had been built up into big buildings. And new people had moved to the neighborhood and were no longer interested in waking up in the middle of the night to the sound of a confused rooster.
But were they still growing food there, or was it mostly flowers?
In the particular garden next to my building, that was preserved, and people were still growing food, and there was still the occasional rooster thrown in after a cockfight often. So that continued, but there was something new happening in the city, and that is elsewhere. I met young professionals who were really interested in keeping backyard chickens and raising their own eggs and really creating a new kind of food production in the city.
Did one person lead you to the next? Because this is kind of a hidden world.
It is. You know, I spent years talking with people about their long-time food production and their new food production. And every time I met somebody, I would ask them, so who do you know producing something interesting? Or who do you know interesting producing food? Or what are some good stories about this? So one person definitely led me to an next.
And how did you come in contact with these two gentlemen?
I met Imran through some other people who had made a film, actually, about his career change and his move to create this slaughterhouse in Queens because he had worked in advertising before this and decided
to take... That's a perfect preparation for working in a slaughterhouse. I worked in advertising, so...
Yeah, it worked out great. You know, I was able to utilize...
Cleaning out the stables is a good preparation for working in advertising.
You know, what I loved about Imran was that he was really idealistic about the reasons he wanted to operate the slaughterhouse. He took it over from his father, who was born in Pakistan, and even though Imran was born here, he really felt strongly about being able to provide sustenance to this immigrant community for whom the fresh meat they could get from a slaughterhouse was more than just dinner. It was actually recreating this tradition.
Had you always intended to take over the business?
No, actually, that was probably the last thing I thought I would do. It was just one of those things where it got to a point in my career I wasn't feeling completely fulfilled, and my father was like, yeah, why don't you give it a shot? I dropped everything and took over, and it was one of those things you, once you start, you become passionate about it because you see how much the community relies on you. You know, each day people come to get a live chicken, you know, for that evening's meal. So,
well, had it been a part of your childhood?
You know, but it was something I never thought about. I never wanted to go to the chicken market. It smelled, and you know, I stayed away from it as much as I could. And as I got older, that's when I realized it was such an important part of my family's life, the community, and myself.
Are most of your customers from Ozone Park?
Yeah, the majority of the customers are from Ozone Park. The walk-in deli customers live right in the vicinity. And then also we do a lot of restaurants in the city as well.
Well, that Ozone Park used to be mostly Italian and Polish. Has it become a strong Muslim center as well?
Yeah, it's where we're located. It's very diverse. A lot of Southeast Asians, South Asians, West Indian. And there's a very large Muslim community, also a very large Hindu community. And there's, you still have pockets of Italians and Irish. So they're you know, but it's changed quite a bit over the last couple of decades.
And do you have customers who are not Muslims who also just want fresh meat?
I would say probably the majority of our customers, I would say about 75% are non-Muslim. They come to us because they want that fresh kill. And also we offer breeds that you wouldn't be able to get anywhere else.
So I assume different people want different things.
Absolutely. Each type of bird has a different culinary use. Some birds you would use for soup, some you'd use for stews, others for grilling or roasting.
And not everybody likes goats, but some do.
Right.
Some, well, would like lamb, others
Absolutely. Don't.
Robin, New York is a city of immigrants. Though we're seeing something of an urban farming renaissance, are immigrants the ones who have kept alive some of these food-making traditions over the decades?
That has been true for a very long time. I think people don't realize that long past the time when New York City had agricultural spaces, long past the time when it had industrial food production on large scales, immigrants kept these traditions alive because they came from places where it was natural to produce your own food, and they kind of insisted on doing this when they arrived in a hostile environment of a crowded, densely packed city with very little space or amenities for food production.
Well, Latif, your family made wine in Iraq, but wine is banned in a Muslim country, isn't it?
That is correct, but Jews and Christians were allowed to make wine and liquor and sell it. So it was common among Jews and Christians to do that.
And how much did you know about winemaking when suddenly you found yourself with this giant beanstalk?
Well, I knew very little. All I knew is that my father made it, and the way he made it was extremely primitive. I didn't know that at the time. But since I started doing it, I realized that he violated every rule. And the wine came out all right. It didn't seem to spoil or turn into vinegar. So,
and what happened when your wife realized that the garden now was becoming a vineyard?
Well, it was a little too late. We didn't realize that the first season that the vine started to have grapes. And we noticed it only towards the end of the season. So it was very exciting. It was very nice to see grapes in our backyard, and it tasted good, so she was happy about it.
A listener, Elaine, asks on our show page, do you have any concerns about contaminants in the soil? Because we've talked about that in the past. Most people, when they grow food to eat, will put it in pots or boxes or whatever, raised beds, because the soil here is just not the same as you're going to find out in the Amish country in Pennsylvania.
That is correct. Fortunately, vines, grapevines, tolerate very bad soil. In fact, the soil in the backyard, in our backyard, people used to dump whatever is left in their furnace, heating furnace in the backyard. So we had to get rid of some of that. But still, it's not the greatest soil. but the wine is okay. It's the story that counts.
In fact, they say that if the grapes have to struggle to survive, they make better wine.
Well, that may very well be.
My guests are Latif Gigi, who's, you're calling your wine Chateau Latif?
I call it Chateau Latif. It was my wife's idea to call it Chateau Latif.
And Imran Uddin, who owns a slaughterhouse in Queens. And we're talking with Robin Shulman, who's written a book called Eat the City, A Tale of the Fishers, Foragers, Butchers, Farmers, Poultry Minders, Sugar Refiners, Cane Cutters, Beekeepers, Winemakers, and Brewers, who built New York City. It is published by Crown. And next time, Robin, we're going to have a shorter subtitle, or else we're not going to have an opportunity
kind of
to have much
twister.
Of a conversation. We'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Robin Shulman, whose book is called Eat the City. I'm going to keep it down to that. It's published by Crown. And we are joined by two people who she has written about in the book, Imran Uddin and Latif Gigi. Robin, did working on this book take you to places in the city that you didn't even know existed?
I went to neighborhoods throughout the city, distant neighborhoods in all boroughs of the city, and to my surprise, found people producing food in all of them, and really surprising kinds of food production, too. Like in parts of Queens, I found people keeping rabbits for the slaughter to make rabbit stews, and I found people beekeeping on rooftops in the middle of the densest neighborhoods of Manhattan. So throughout the city, I found surprising kinds of food production.
I've spoken to some of the people who keep bees, and they say that we actually have some of the best honey in New York because we don't use pesticides in the family gardens. And so the bees are getting really good, perfectly pure nectar.
It's interesting. Some studies suggest that urban bees actually thrive more than rural bees because in a place like New York, there's such diverse flora for them to draw on. And in contemporary rural agriculture, you'll have only one single crop. And so before that crop blooms and after it dies, the bees don't have much to eat. So New York honey is unique in a lot of ways, and pesticides are one of them.
Now, Latif, wine has been made in New York State for quite a while, usually in the Hudson Valley and then upstate in the Finger Lakes area, more recently in the North Fork of Long Island. But do you know of many other winemakers who are growing stuff right here in the city?
There are people who make wine in the city, but they don't grow their own grapes. Some of them buy juice and turn it into wine, and some buy grapes. That's very common.
Mm-hmm. But you're one of the only ones, or the only one, who's actually started your own vine. There are other people who grow grapes in New York City.
I know of no other winery in the city that grows its own grapes and make wine.
Well, when I was a kid, I actually lived in Ozone Park, and we lived in a house where my landlord had a grape arbor. So, but he just, you know, we would pick the grapes when they became ripe and eat them. I don't think he ever thought of making wine. But this is a way for you to stay connected to your childhood in Iraq after having lived here?
It certainly does. And it turned out to be more than I had expected because it became very much a family ritual. And it brought friends and strangers to our place. And everyone in the family looks forward to it. It's intergenerational. People have a good time. They work very hard, and they seem to come back each year.
How many bottles are you able to produce in a typical year?
Yes, that
depends. Do you
think
in terms of cases?
That depends on the harvest. Not every year we get the same amount. The record is 712 pounds in one season. That will make about 150 bottles. Usually we make about 75 to 100.
And how do you prevent animals from eating your grapes, birds especially?
That is very interesting. I have absolutely no problems with pests, with birds eating the grapes. It seems to survive without much attention.
The real problem you had was when your neighbor did the renovation and damaged the roots of the vine, right? Different city grape.
Yes, they dug up the backyard and cut half the roots.
Very smart of them. Robin, you joined Latif, his family, and his friends for the harvest?
Yeah, I've been going there for some years now. It's been at least 5 years, I think.
You don't take off your shoes and crush the grapes with your bare feet, do you?
No, not at Latif's place, although some people do.
Imran, are people surprised by the quality of the meat that you serve? Because it's, I'm sure, based on what you've said, it's higher than you can find in many of the wealthy neighborhoods.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, people, they try it once and they always come back. It's also because we also, the birds we get, we have several different varieties. They're raised differently. Some are pasture raised, some are organic, and all natural. So we have something for everyone.
Now, halal rules are similar to kosher rules. What makes it different?
Well, first of all, halal is it's done by any practicing Muslim. The prayer is said over it, but yes, they're very similar.
It's really the prayers and the butchering technique.
Yeah, it's very similar in that aspect. Also, you don't have to be. A specific type of person. Like, I believe in kosher law, forgive me for if I mispronounce it, but a chashrut.
Pretty good.
Thank you. With halal, it can be any practicing Muslim. They can perform the ritual themselves.
Now, many people are squeamish about seeing an animal killed before them. There used to be a time when there were a lot of places where you can get live chickens, live poultry all around
sure.
the city. There are only a few now. Is that different for immigrant communities?
Yeah, it's, you know, I think it's especially popular in immigrant communities for the fact that a lot of these people, they leave their homelands, they come to the United States to start a new life. And this is something that they have that is, you know, reminds them of home. So it's very important in the immigrant communities.
Does it taste the same as it did back in the homeland?
A lot of people claim it does. They say it reminds them of home. They get that flavor because the chicken fresh kill is completely different than store bought or anything that's been refrigerated or frozen. Texture's different, flavors are different, and also the way the animals are raised. That we get, it affects the quality of the meat, the flavor, texture, everything.
Does it have to be eaten very quickly after the slaughter, as it is in the Jewish tradition? Because the top chefs will tell you that if you really want tender beef, for example, you have to age it for a while.
Sure. So there's a lot of people have different, views on that. But the majority of our customers, they come in for specifically for the fact that, it's fresh. And they bring it home and they start cooking it immediately. With chicken, I personally think it's best to have it fresh killed rather than freezing it. We have a lot of people literally that come each day for one chicken that they cook that night. They'll come back the next day for another one.
Is it... are there rules on how the animals are raised?
Absolutely.
Because right now there are a lot of people who are concerned about the kind of feed that especially pigs and cows and chickens mm-hmm. are being given.
Sure, absolutely. I deal with farms that, raise them, humanely. They're given sufficient food, water. The feed is, either organic, and they're given sufficient food and water. But I also deal with farms that allow me to go to the farm, see what's going on. So I know what I'm getting. And also, I allow my customers, every year I go a couple times a year to the farms with customers to see the farms that they're getting their birds from.
My guests are Robin Shulman, who has written a book called Eat the City, a tale of the fishers, foragers, butchers, farmers, poultry minders, sugar refiners, cane cutters, beekeepers, winemakers, and brewers who built New York. It's published by Crown. And also two of the people who are featured in the book, Imran Uddin, whose Madan Halal slaughterhouse is in...
Madani.
Madani, I'm sorry, is in Ozone Park. And also Latif Jili, whose winery, Chateau Latif, is in the Upper East Side in a brownstone.
Yes.
This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Robin, you write about how Italian families in Red Hook would bury their bottles of red wine in the backyard to age them.
Yeah,
are people still finding some of those?
I talked to people who recently have done gardening projects in their backyards in Brooklyn and come up with perfectly aged red.
from Prohibition days, because you were allowed to make your own wine during Prohibition. You just couldn't buy wine from other people.
Yeah, there was an exemption for home winemaking, which the Italians took great advantage of. People would describe walking through Italian neighborhoods during Prohibition and even afterwards and kind of smelling the scent of fermentation coming from every basement because every family had a little spot their landlord had dedicated to their winemaking.
And they were making wines that were very much like what you would have gotten in Italy if you'd made your own.
Maybe not as fine as what you might have gotten in Italy if you'd made your own.
That's what kept the Zinfandel going, because of those they liked the Zinfandel grapes. So when you go to California, you find old vine Zinfandels. You can't find old vine anything else because they kept the vines growing for all of the Italian immigrants who wanted to do the home winemaking.
It really kept the vineyards going during Prohibition because suddenly they were shipping all these grapes off to Italian neighborhoods in American cities for winemaking.
Latif, you, as you said, you use the Niagara grape. Could you use other grapes?
Yes, I could, but it will take it years to mature.
Well, there are other sticks out there, aren't there?
Well, also, I'll have to get my wife's permission, so that's...
Well, you'd have to find another brownstone where you could cover the roof.
Well, the vine already overwhelms everything.
Now, do you find other people are inspired to consider doing it themselves when they come and see what you're doing?
I don't know if other people have followed up and did the same thing, but in general, people are very amused by the whole thing and interested in participating and... they come back again and again.
And this is a sweet wine that you produce?
It's a sweet wine, white wine.
Robin, we weren't able to talk about some of the other people who you have profiled in this book. Are there any that you think would have been great to talk to? I mean, these two gentlemen have been fabulous, but if we could have filled the studio with a lot of different people.
Yeah, you know, my book has 7 chapters based on different foods. So there are chapters on meat and fish and vegetables and honey and sugar and wine and beer. And pretty much every chapter has a really fascinating story of a person. But one of my favorites is a man named Willie Morgan, who lives in Farlam, and he has a vegetable garden. And he actually first grew vegetables in the late 1960s. Because he thought of them as a front for his gambling racket. He had a numbers joint, and he hoped that he could disguise what was actually going on by making it look like a greengrocer. So he went down to the Department of Consumer Affairs. He got a license to operate a greengrocer. He set up stands in his storefront where he could have vegetables. But the trouble was he didn't have any vegetables. So he decided to grow them in the vacant lot next door. But his story is actually much larger than that, because he's part of a generation of African Americans that came from the South as part of the Great Migration and came from rural farming backgrounds and came to a city where for the first time they had to buy most of their food rather than produce it. And they made do. Many people created fire escape vegetable plots and created ways to produce food in a very densely packed city. But really, in the 1960s, when neighborhoods like Harlem started to deteriorate and buildings came down by fire and by abandonment and left vacant spaces, those people really took advantage of that and decided to produce food there.
And so now he's gone straight and he just produces food.
Now it's just the food, not the numbers.
How many of these people are selling things in the green markets?
I know of various small urban farms in the city that are producing food for sale in local markets.
Well, in your case, Latif, you're producing 150 bottles in the best years. That's not a lot of wine. So you're not selling any of it, are you?
No, I'm not selling any. Usually people who come to help with the harvest and making the wine or the labels, we also make our own labels, they go home with a bottle of wine.
And, of course, your wife enjoys the wine, so she's not complaining anymore.
No, she's not complaining.
Latif Gigi, who bottles the wine called Chateau Latif, Imran Uddin, who is the proprietor of the Madani Halal Slaughterhouse in Ozone Park, and Robin Schulman, who is the author of Eat the City, A Tale of the Fishers, Foragers, Butchers, Farmers, Poultry Minders, Sugar Refiners, Cane Cutters, Beekeepers, Winemakers, and Brewers Who Built New York. It's published by Crown. Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.